Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be hearing from Annie B. Parson, the choreographer, dancer and director whose new production looks at the life and times of Samuel Pepys and whose CV includes work with talents ranging from St. Vincent to David Byrne.
We'll also be catching up with Turner Prize winning artist and art rocker Martin Creed, as well as Fatosh Ustek, director of the David Roberts Art Foundation, to hear about an intimate night of performance taking place this week.
And we'll be discussing a new documentary from Monocle's very own Sheena Rossiter, looking at issues of gender and sexuality in Brazil.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to some of next week's news today. And we've a tune or two for you as well, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Oh, what a week. It's been very busy at Midori House up in the office. And quite an exciting time generally in London. Looking ahead to next week, of course, Org. Frieze is in town. There's all sorts of arts happening. I feel culturally nourished here in the city at the moment.
It's good, isn't it? It's been a fallow period over the summer, kind of scratching around for exhibitions here and there. But there's a lot coming up. Possibly too much.
There can never be too much. And I feel we have a delicious slice of cultural sustenance on offer for our listeners on today's programme. Shall we to the Monocle Weekly?
Let's. There was something in the air that night.
The stars were bright. Fernando. The signature tune of our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who has sashayed into the studio to join us. Faye, welcome.
Thank you for that word. I like that. Sashay. Sashay away.
Now, let's kind of maneuver ourselves around next week's news today. Where should we start?
Well, first of all, guys, today is Sunday, and you know where I'm heading to? Brazil. In just, you know, a few hours, I'm heading there because I'll be covering for Monocle the, you know, the week before the election, basically. So, you know, when the next Monocle Weekly will happen, Brazilians will be there voting, including myself. But what an election to cover. I mean, it's been one of the most unpredictable ever. Well, we had a candidate, the leading candidate, who was stabbed. And now we had a movement of women against him because of his, you know, very sexist views and very bad economic plans as well. Not many people are talking about that.
Not forgetting racism and homophobia as well.
Yes. Doses of that as well. And then we have Fernando Haddad from the Workers' Party, which is all governed by Lula, who is in jail. So yes, it is a very good election to cover.
I was going to mention Lula because, of course, that's a sort of bizarre backdrop to this. The guy who would probably win this election at an absolute canter is still in the, staying at the Grey Bar Hotel. We know about this quite tempestuous nature of Brazilian politics, Faye. You and I have talked about it here on Monocle 24 for 5-6 years or more. This election, though, seems to have up the ante again, so unpredictable. Do you think there's any more clarity about what might happen? You know, the spectre of Bolsonaro, we still don't think he's going to win. Could Brazilian politics settle down at all after Sunday?
Definitely not. That I can tell you. I think the second round will be Bolsonaro and Haddad, which, funnily enough, they're the two leading candidates in the polls, but they're also the two most rejected. So Brazilians will definitely vote for the least worst of them when it comes to the polls. And I don't think the only thing that I find it a bit sad that, you know, for the next 4 years, I can certainly see already problems in the Congress, because in Brazil you need a big coalition, and both candidates, I mean, more Bolsonaro, let's be clear here, will have lots of difficulties in doing that. So yes, this kind of new blood, new energy, I don't think it arrived yet in the presidential race, but it will be a very good one to cover, as I said before.
Indeed. Worrying stuff. Where are we going next?
Well, we're heading back to the UK. So on Thursday, you have something called Super Thursday. Sorry, I don't like those names, but in the publishing world, that's the name. I think this is the most important date for the publishing world, at least in the UK. But I think a lot of countries have similar Super Thursdays. So basically, do you know how many titles will be released in the UK on the bookshops? 660. That's a lot. And, you know, because, of course, all the offering for Christmas, which is, again, you know, that's when the sales happen, will be released around this time. So, you know, I don't know about the, you know, that cool indie author, you know, but we have, you know, we have Michelle Obama's new book. David Attenborough has a new book as well. And Anthony Joshua.
Yeah. Will you be reading that?
Probably not. I do find, I must say, the Sportsman cranking out, you know, a sort of autobiography or a half dozen by the, you know, how old's Anthony Joshua?
He's like late 20s?
Yeah. Late 20s.
I mean, he's achieved a great deal, don't get me wrong. He's a compelling character. But surely wait until you've retired before you start the sort of memoiring, no?
But Tom, you know about sports books. I mean, that's sure. Big sell. Big I think it's a good kind of, well, I'm not saying it's good, but it's a very common Secret Santa gift as well. Sorry, I'm looking a bit too early into it.
I have to say, were I an author, I might feel rather depressed if my book came out and was swallowed by the 660 or 659 others on Super Thursday.
Maybe wait a week and then you can be there.
I'll be sure to tell my agent that when the time comes.
Absolutely. Well, and my final topic, I mean, we're talking about Super Thursday. The Oscar season already started, and this Friday...
Hasn't the Oscars just... I'm losing track with reality, Fernando.
Basically, when I talk about Oscar season, it's like American elections. As soon as they elect a new president... The season started already, you know, so it's a never-ending game. But the new, film directed by Bradley Cooper with Lady Gaga, Star is Born. And some people are saying that it's an early favorite to win the Oscars. I mean, the reviews have been amazing. And this, let's remember, is the third time this film have been shown on screens. I think they had, the first one was 1937, and then Barbara Streisand did a great kind of remake of it in the 70s, and people are loving it.
And it's true. I was reading some previews this week. Is it Glenn Close is in a film? She's apparently delivered a career-defining performance, and people are mentioning her as a possible Best Actress winner as early as whatever we're in, September, October time. Seems very early.
Yeah, she did The Wife.
This is it?
Yeah. So I very much look forward to see this one. It's out already.
I think it's on now, because it always used to be said that you risked sort of going too soon with the kind of Oscar releases, and actually people wanted to wait until more like the seasonal time or even early in the year itself. But it looks like that's changing. And maybe the Academy's memory is a little longer and they can go back to the preceding autumn for some of their favourites.
Certainly changing. Remember earlier this year, when Get Out was nominated for quite a few Oscars, it has been released February 2017. Mm. So, and I think it might happen the same with Black Panther, which was released February this year. So I think, I think it's bad for the public when there's so many Oscar films in November. I think it's nice to spread out throughout the year. Maybe they should do the same with the Super Thursday for books.
Well, quite. And of course, there'll be a new category this year, won't there, for the best rubbish film.
That was cancelled.
Ah!
Because of the backlash by, I think the journalists helped, because nobody liked the idea, because I think people were saying, well, there'll be a bit demeaning for a film like Black Panther to be nominated for Best Popular Film. So now I think the Oscar committee, they're thinking what they're going to do with this category.
They're going to lower the standards all over.
I'm glad the category is not there, actually, because I do believe Black Panther should be nominated for Best Film, not Best Popular Film.
Thanks, Fernando. Always good to catch up with you. You're listening to the Monica Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from artist Martin Creed. Don't go away. Over the past 10 years, the David Roberts Art Foundation, or DRAF, has brought a consistently dynamic lineup of artists and performers to the stage for its annual Evening of Performances. Last year, the event branched off on its own, taking over North London's iconic Coco.
This year, for its 11th iteration, the Evening of Performances will be exploring the theme of intimacy in Kentish Town's Art Deco 02 Forum. Joining us now to explore the complexities of staging intimacy in an 1,800-capacity venue is DRAF's founder, Fatos Ustek, as well as participating artist and former weekly guest, Martin Creed. Martin, Fatos, great to have you with us.
So, Fatos, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what to expect from this Evening of Performances and a bit about the history of it as well.
Mm-hmm. With pleasure. Thank you for the invitation, Tom and Augustine. It's really a pleasure to be here today and with Martin as well. So Evening of Performances is our annual event. DRAF, David Roberts Art Foundation, is celebrating its 11th year this year. Every year from its incarnation, we have hosted an Evening of Performances that was dedicated to inviting artists to come up with ideas for a performance or even perform on the site. And last year, to celebrate our 10th year anniversary, we actually moved out of our premises and celebrated the 10th year at Coco. And this year, we are again on offsite because now we also no longer have a venue yet in London. So we will be at O2 Forum, Kentish Town.
And we should talk a little about that, Martin, because it's a sort of bigger venue yet even than Coco. And there's some interesting reasons behind that. Right. But I guess that's pretty exciting, right?
Aye, but I think it's the bigger, the better. I like the Forum. I've been there to quite a few times. as good as I think it'll be nice and loud.
Well, how do you go about then, if I were sort of putting together, I don't know, the lineup, looking at the structure? You've got some incredibly exciting and capable, super talented people to work with. How do you go about structuring it in your mind? Do you start with a truly sort of blank canvas? Give us a sense of that.
Yeah, with pleasure. So I'm a new director. It's been only 6 months that I started working at Droff. And this is my first project. And from this year onwards, we will have an annual theme that kind of crosses throughout all our programming. And this year we are looking at human condition, what makes us human. And I think it's very timely and contingent. At the same time, I'm not interested in, you know, like propaganda or trying to kind of like make a slogan out of it. But every project that we do this year is going to fall under that umbrella. So for Droff, annual evening of performances, we are concentrating on the concept of intimacy or the notion of intimacy. What is intimacy? It's a very ephemeral notion, and it's kind of like filled with curiosity, empathy, vulnerability, and to recognize the fact that we cannot be in the place of each other, but still we can create that relationship that it feels close. And it can be sensual, sexual, physical, but it can also be very intellectual and cognitive. So when I was putting together the artist lineup, and it's such an excitement that all the artists are producing new works, and with one work we're doing a UK premiere, every artist is responding to the theme, but not necessarily illustrate what they think intimacy is, but taking it as a key to explore how could we also enhance the art encounter. So the whole lineup is going to be quite a big wavelength of, you know, like feeling, you know, like hot and cold, excited and contemplative, or loud and silent.
I should ask, I mean, the kind of challenges of generating intimacy in a sort of 1800 capacity venue aside, which must be quite large. How did you kind of come to respond to this theme, Martin?
I feel like it fits in with everything that I try to do. I mean, themes for shows and things like that, I don't know. I think it's difficult because when I try to work, I'm just trying to work without prejudice, you know, not to pre-decide anything. So I wouldn't want to be trying to fit in with a theme, but I feel like the things that I do fit in with it because, like, I think of it as trying, like, if I'm doing a show, like, I'm trying not to put on a show. You know, I don't like it when people are sort of professional and I feel like they're putting up a wall, you know. I would like to try to communicate with other people directly, not sort of putting up a facade that looks like a person.
So in a practical sense, what does that kind of mean for this? Like, how are you going to kind of bring that to
this?
Well,
to a certain extent, it means like not actually not planning things very... I find that if I plan things too much, that it takes a life out of them, you know. And the more you plan things, the more you plan for, you know, you get worried in advance. And so you plan to make everything safer. And I think that usually reduces the amount of, you know, humanity in the work because, you know, because humans are alive, changing things. And so you don't really know what's going to happen with a person. But with some dead thing that you've worked all out, well, you know what's going to happen with that. So you can feel better about it yourself. But that's not necessarily get more, you know, life in it.
I'm the one for you. I'm your two.
I think usually it's to kind of make a framework where I don't try not to plan too much, but plan enough to, well, you know, to try and put on something. It's a fine line between, you know, I don't know, like kind of like self-indulgence, you know, and whatever the opposite of self-indulgence is. Oh no, I can't remember.
But I just wonder, is that an ongoing concern? Because I guess in works that rely a bit on a bit of humour, maybe some levity, that kind of spontaneity, aye. Martin, that's important. Presumably that's an ongoing challenge with your general practice. Because I guess the bigger the venues, the greater the expectations, it's harder to allow yourself that spontaneity. Are you sort of constantly trying to kind of strike that balance?
I don't know. I just don't know how you do that either. But I think I try to do it by changing and doing different things where I don't necessarily know what I'm doing. You know, I think I feel like the great danger is when you start thinking you know what you're doing. I mean, I think someone that knows what they're doing is not going to be a nice person to hang around with. So I try and change what I do. I mean, for this concert, this show or thing, I'm doing a thing with a string quartet. And I have worked with a string quartet before, but it's quite a new thing for me.
And it's presumably super exciting, Vatush, but I guess there is an element of a bit of jeopardy, risk, calculated. Mm-hmm. But that must be very exciting and thrilling to have this sort of framework and then allow people like Martin to sort of kind of just take the baton, if you'll forgive an orchestral pun there, and kind of run with it a little bit. That must be very exciting as a thing to preside
over.
No,
absolutely. I mean, one of, I think, my assets in curating is that I can take risks and I can embrace the unknown and uncertainty. All the artists we have is basically chosen because of the nature of their practices or how they chose to respond to different concepts and different themes or what they do in their body of work. But there are, you know, like, as I said, it's all new commissions except one piece. For instance, we have Stacey Makishi, and she's going to do a stand-up comedy on the night, and she's going to talk about shame. And I know an outline of what's going to happen, but I don't know the piece. And it's going to be half an hour, you know, monologue of her on stage activating the audiences and kind of evoking these, you know, like, let's say, these moments of intimacy and laughter and sadness. Or, you know, like, we have Bob Kill, and she's going to make a very sensual performance. Or you know, like, it's... Or Fiona Banner is going to be much more like a rapture into the whole flow. So it's very nice, but I haven't seen any work in full until I will on Tuesday. And I think that's so very exciting. And I think it's also a privilege to do that as a curator, because I don't think, I mean, of course, we need to know how many strings are going to be there and how many amps do we need. And then also, like, does the screen need to be, you know, like 10x6 or 4x5? So those things, those kind of, like, let's say, support structures need to be known so that when improvisation needs to take place, we can support it to happen.
Giving Martin a very serious look there. They do need to be known.
Yeah, we know that. We know who's coming.
From a kind of curatorial perspective, you have this sort of meta narrative overarching the year's programming, and intimacy came together. Did the artists sort of present themselves as obvious choices when you were sort of putting together the program?
I mean, it was like, it's actually... Every show, every project has an extensive research underneath. Or that I've been, like, some of the artists I knew that I really wanted to work with from the beginning, and some of the other artists I chose through the media that they're working with, and some of the other artists were basically very exciting to invite to challenge them with, hey, what can you do new? And that was also one of our conversations with Martin. I've been following his practice for a long time, but my excitement was, can we do something that you haven't done before? So that also becomes a really exciting new input into your thinking, into your world.
And do these things do they have that effect? Do they catalyze shifts in your approach to your practice sometimes, these kind of moments when you're...
Yeah, absolutely. I think that... to be invited to do something like this, you know, makes me, partly it forces me to get out of bed and do things, because although I am always trying to do things, but when someone asks you and it's an exciting thing, it's all, you know, that's how things happen, I think. I mean, sometimes if no one is asking me anything, I might just jump off the cliff. Anyway, I find something to put myself into some situation where, like that. When I'm left to my own devices, I tend to spiral down into, you know, some weird world. I don't know what it is. But so it helps me. So it's a great help to be invited to do something, but also to be invited to do something new. I often get asked to do things that are old or to do something that's like something that I did before, but new. As opposed to just new, you know.
What just
and then, so this was an open invitation,
and too good to turn down, presumably. Well, how about, Martin, we just take a bit of a step back. Where are we at the moment in terms of the kind of broad cultural landscape? There's lots of depressing stuff going on in this country, and I think it's great to be talking about intimacy and aspects of humanity when there's so much bitterness and resentment and all the sort of bad sentiment around. Frieze is coming up. There's lots of exciting cultural dynamism still in London. Are you reassured that this is still a great place to work, to show, to talk about these positive things with people? Do you ever get down by some of those other narratives?
I think everywhere's a great place. I know what you mean about the current state of things, but I don't know. I mean, I grew up in the famous Thatcher years, you know, and that were supposed to be terrible, and they were in many, you know, they were terrible, but
they inspired some great art.
A lot of people did loads of brilliant things, and you know, when I say they were supposed to be terrible, I mean that lots of people did brilliant things during those years. It's not, in a way, you know, terrible situations. The reason they might, you know, often lead to more creative work. I don't know if that's really true. Mm. But it might just be because life is a terrible situation, you know. And
I'm caught between labelling that incredibly optimistic and slightly pessimistic at once. But
so I was more like, you know, at the moment Britain's just more like life, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's more, it's. And I think it's good not to go around feeling deluded about life.
I think that's absolutely quite brilliant, Martin.
Fatos, more broadly, I just wanted to ask, you know, as a curator who's really on it, what else should we be looking out for sort of over Frieze Week? This is like an explosion of culture in the city. Yours is just the first of many excellent things that will be taking place. Where are you going to be going? What are you going to be looking for?
Yeah, it's really an incredible week coming ahead, but ours is the biggest. You have to, you cannot not miss this. You know, like now that I know you, I will be looking at you in the audience. So it's really going to be an incredible week, and there's like many big commissions or many big projects. I mean, the ones that I can list on top of my head, I haven't yet had the chance to visit Hayward Space Shifters show, and apparently that's brilliant. And I'm looking forward to what New Museum is going to do at the Vinyl Factory. And there's another thing, I mean, like, it sounds like self-promotion, but I really would like you to go and visit the latest commission by Doho Su. It's the largest in the UK. I worked on it for the last 2 years. It's unveiled last Monday, and it is his childhood home landed on a bridge, a pedestrian bridge on Wormwood Street in the city of London. Please do not miss that.
That sounds incredible.
A wealth of cultural treasures. And the one that you two are involved with is on Tuesday night. Maybe just remind us, Fatos, like, how do people find out more if they want to come along?
Yes. So we have free tickets, but it would be great if you can book your ticket in advance, because we will only have those iPads to register people coming in. So it's on Eventbrite. And if you just Google Draft Evening of Performances, or if you go to our website, davidrobertsartfoundation.com, you can find information on the lineup, on all the artists, the commissions, and the Eventbrite link. And it's going to be at O2 Forum, Kentish Town. It's so close to the Kentish Town Tube, literally 3 minutes walking distance, and it's also close to the Kentish Town Overground or Gospel Oak. It will be around 7 minutes walking.
There you go.
And come early.
You've done the GPS call. Martin, maybe a last word to you. We've talked a little bit about a string quartet, of course. You've talked about the kind of slightly unplanned almost nature of it. What's the one liner for what people might expect to see, at least from your contribution to the night?
Well, I don't know. I've been working on the string quartet. That is actually written out in the form of musical notes, but I keep changing around all the different sections, and so we haven't actually managed to play it all the way through yet. And so I don't really know. What the fuck am I feeling? I can't believe my heart. What? Fuck am I thinking? I can't believe my head. Where the fuck am I going?
And Draft's annual evening of performances will be taking place this Tuesday evening, as we've just heard, at the O2 Forum in Kentish Town in North London. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
In a moment, we'll be hearing from choreographer and director Annie B. Parson about her production 17C. But first, let's hear a tune from David Byrne, one of her many collaborators whose recent live shows she devised the moves for. This is Every Day is a Miracle.
That was David Byrne from his American Utopia album, the critically lauded live shows for which were brought to the stage with direction from choreographer Annie B. Parson.
Since co-founding New York's Big Dance Theatre Company in the early 90s, Annie B. Parson's been at the centre of innovative productions that push movement into new territory, the latest of which is 17C, a combination of dance, words and music, retelling the 17th century story of one of London's most renowned diarists, Samuel Pepys. It looks to bring female voices, often omitted from Pepys' work, to the fore.
Earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall met Annie B. Parson at London's Old Vic Theatre, where 17C has just hit the stage as part of London's Dance Umbrella Festival.
This performance called 17C is primarily about the diaries of Samuel Pepys from the 17th century, but it's also about unearthing what's underneath the diaries, what's not written about. So there's a couple of different layers that the audience will experience. One is the writing of Samuel Pepys, which is entirely uncensored, almost hypergenerative. He writes about everything. And he writes about it very non-hierarchically, like he doesn't really differentiate between an experience with a stomachache, a toothache, and meeting the king. They're all important to write down. He doesn't seem to feel that one has more value than another. It's almost like he just needs to write everything down in order to experience it fully. Almost to the point that if something super dramatic is happening in his life, he's excited about it, even if it's very, very negative in its consequences, so he has more to write about. So in a sense, he's a writer or an artist, but he's also not an artist because he doesn't, from my perspective, interpret anything at all that happens. He's largely looking at things as they are. It feels a little bit postmodern in a sense. There's no metaphor. There's no play with language at all. It's just get it down. So you feel like it's some effort that needs to be made, almost physical.
I wanted to ask you, what's the difference between an artist who documents our times and then someone who is called a diarist like Samuel Pepys? What are the two things that separate those documents of what we're going through in contemporary moments?
Well, it's complicated because I feel like a diarist is writing for themselves. An artist may be also working for themselves, but there's a sense of interpretation. There's a sense of something prismatic in a sense of the way that they look at the world. So it may have many, many aspects to it that are happening at once, almost like a gemstone. Or it doesn't, but they come at the world from a certain angle. And also they play with form. Form is a huge part of my work and most artists' work, if not the subject matter itself. With a diarist, typically the diary is the form, the dear diary, the dailiness, that is the form. It's a beautiful form. But it's not reinvented, and the reinvention of form is what the artist does, in a sense. They change the form, which is almost why computers can't ever become Beethoven, because they don't change the form. They can only reiterate what Beethoven did.
Pepys himself, certainly by today's standards, he would not be considered a very pleasant man all the time. Are you trying to reapproach his diaries and add today's viewpoint to them? Is that what you're trying to expose, really?
You can't not look at Pepys right now and think of him from the perspective of the Me Too moment. But that's what the audiences bring, because actually, I made this piece a couple of years ago, and just as a feminist, this has been my subject matter since I started making work. So it's not new for me, but I can feel that the audiences are filling in a lot of blanks. And right now, as I'm watching rehearsal, I'm really thinking about the whole judgeship and the Kavanaugh thing. I'm obsessed with it. I'm completely concerned. I think it's a lose-lose. And there's an aspect of the piece I made that has to do with these annotators, and they're contemporary annotators that are writing and thinking about a writer from 350 years ago. That's one of the layers in the piece. And when they talk about what Pepys did, it's sounds really like a consideration of what we're grappling with Judge Kavanaugh. The reflection, the refraction of contemporary times is you couldn't keep it out of the room. But this is because it's always going on, and it's been going on in literature forever, because literature is a reflection of the author's perspective on the world. So I chose in this piece to figure out a way to right the wrong of the absence of women in the diary. They are virtually erased, but you could also see that as subject matter in a sense, and see the erasure marks like as if a pencil was just going over and over and over, trying to rub out these people that were part of Pepys's life, and particularly his wife, Elizabeth. So I tried to bring her onto the stage, also Margaret Cavendish, and I tried to resurrect her, exhume her from the cemetery of literature.
So when you sort of approach that in a creative sense, how do you begin to fill in those gaps? Is it pure imagination, or do you research, you know, extensively historically? How do you approach that?
It's kind of both. I mean, I'm not a writer per se, but I did look to some of the texts that had been written to also look at who Bess Pepys was. Some of them are fictional biographies of her, and I didn't find anything in them that I could relate to. My imagination didn't create her to be in any way like those books had been written. So what I decided to do was to first make a lot of movement material for her, which I did, but then I still felt like, not that the I Feel text is primary or anything like that, but I still felt like she had to literally have a voice. So I went to the writings of the most circular in nature text I could think of, and that's the 1960s dance critic, Jill Johnson. And she was an important New York City dance critic, and she wrote a lot about the performance that was going on in the 60s, which is like very inspiring for me as a choreographer and sort of my parents, so to speak, in my family tree of dance. So I had read her a lot, and I love the way that she writes, and it's very, very contradictory. It's got a lot of circularity, as I said. It's got a strangeness to it that Pepys doesn't hold in any way. So I loved the sort of idea that his wife was, or I created her to be, extremely different from him. It's up for grabs what she was like, because vis-a-vis research, if you read deeply into the diaries, it seems to me that he burned her diaries. I was positive that she had written a diary. I was positive because people wrote diaries at the time, and women wrote diaries, and she was alone a lot, and she had very few friends, and that came up a lot, and she didn't go out a lot. So I imagined fairly likely she wrote a diary. You know, lack of television, no social media, she probably wrote a diary. But where was the diary? I found a section in his diary where he talks about being so angry at her that he said he burnt all her papers. And he goes on and on about burning her papers, which I am guessing included her diary.
And then I wanted to come on to some of your other projects, working with other artists, recently David Byrne for his American Utopia shows. When you're working with a presence like that, is it full-on 50-50 collaboration? What does he come to you for? What's your sort of line of interaction on a project like that?
David brings a huge creative force to the table in this case. And this is, I think, the fourth project I'd worked with him on. He was bringing the particular idea of everybody on stage being untethered. He's increasingly wanted to see people move on stage and get rid of the ubiquitous platforming in rock bands, the sort of sloppy line of that drum platform and the keys platform and all that stuff that we just take for granted. He's a rule breaker for sure. He wanted them to be in a box, and he wanted them to wear gray suits. All of that still stands. I mean, all those ideas that he brought to the table on day one were the building blocks of the piece, obviously. I collaborate with him as somebody who is working for him. I'm throwing out a lot of ideas to him, and some of them he wants to try, and some of them he's less interested in. He loves things that are incongruous. He loves things that are physical. He loves things that are abstract. He likes the oblique. He and I share, I feel like, a lot of feelings about how the space should be used and how color should be used. When I said to him, I think everyone should be barefoot, he nodded, of course, you know, like a sense of agreement. I think there isn't a lot. We don't chat a ton about stuff. We more try stuff. I throw out as many ideas as I can. One of my favorite moments with David was a few years ago. We were bringing a show that we did together. It was the one with Brian Eno. And he was going to bring it to Radio City Music Hall, which has this really, really wonderful tradition of dance, but like kickline kinds of dance, the Rockettes and stuff. So I brought in a bunch of white tutus from my basement. And he loves white. He wears a lot of white. He put it right on, and he told everyone in the band to put it on. He never said to me, why would you bring that? I think for him, he saw shape, he saw color. He's compositional and choreographic as an artistic mind by nature. So it's a really, really great collaboration where he's in the lead. Yeah.
You mentioned that sort of traditional, very staid back line of bass guitar, the drum riser. Mm-hmm. And when you're watching that David Byrne show, it's immediately noticeable that people are having to move around with their instruments. They have, you know, their drum strapped around their waist, or that, you know, they're carrying their keyboards in funny ways. Are there conversations there where you're sort of pushing the band to be like, oh, do you reckon you could carry like that? Or is it more, do you get pushback being like, this is not how a musician does their thing or carries their instrument, and you have to sort of make concessions in that way?
It was central to the piece that they could construct harnesses for the drummers and all the musicians to carry their instruments. And these harnesses actually were created just for this show. They're unique and quite brilliant. Having said that, there are limitations to them, and there's a lot of weight that they're carrying. The limitations that the drummers presented to me for almost everything that I suggested that they do were a negotiation between me and the drummers and, well, all the musicians. What can they do while they're playing? And some of them are literally, they can't pick up their knees because they're going to hit their drum all the way to, I'm asking them to walk off the beat and they're playing on the beat. And some of that is practice. David's very, very encouraging of spending the amount of time in rehearsal it needs to push boundaries and to make people do things that they couldn't imagine they did. So when they say, no, no, we can't do that, we say, well, let's try it a few times. And then let's get back to the question, is it possible? And often it is possible. Part of working with musicians is that negotiation between what they can physically do while they're playing. I love that.
Coming back to the performance here at the Old Vic, I know it's a little bit, in a way, dull to try and box everything, but I was just intrigued. It does have speech, it has singing, it's not just dance. How would you sort of term what this performance is? Because it's not a straight-up musical, it's not only dance, it's not a play. What would you call it?
I don't think I can. I'm a little bit allergic to categorizing performance, and I think that's true with David's show too, and it's been a little bit of a struggle too, because some people say it's theater. And I would say 17C, in a sense, is theater with a capital T, meaning that it's theater in the old sense of the word, where you danced and you sang. And the text wasn't primary. That's very, you know, new to the thousands of years of theater, that text was really in the center of the hierarchy, or the top of the hierarchy. For my work, movement, text, structure, design, all these elements coexist. I don't think that you could say that anything is privileged.
I think one perception, I don't know whether it's a misconception, that people have about dance, and I have not seen as much dance as I like, but every time I see it, I'm immediately struck by, I think some people are sort of put off because they think that you need to know about dance to go and see dance, which as soon as you see it, you're immediately disarmed of that sentiment. It's because I find it so much more immediate than spoken theatre, because it's just, you don't need to understand how someone is moving. It's just something that you immediately take in. Are you sort of Is that what you enjoy about dance? It's immediacy and the fact that perhaps you don't need to be completely aware of the context. Or would someone coming to see this show about Samuel Pepys really need to know their stuff about where the content was coming from?
I feel the rational mind is overrated, and at best overrated, and maybe suspect. I mean, a lot of what we bring to the theater, when we're presented with theater that has a thesis to prove, or that the form is so familiar of, you know, setting up the story and creating an obstacle and then resolving it, those kind of experiences that sort of shut off the brain aren't interesting to me. I feel like what you bring to the theater is not your research on the subject matter or your knowledge of past theater, but instead there's this collective audience understanding of what's going on. And it's very, very powerful what's going on in the audience. It's super interesting because it reminds me of dance a little bit. As you say that, there's no words, but somehow we're all sort of, it's almost like this democracy where we're all feeling feelings about the way things should be going. Of course, we've sat in the audience where we disagree with the audience. We've all had that experience, but there is this audience power, and the power is exerted on the play. So the audience should not underestimate what they bring as human beings into the room, as long as they are willing to engage fully, which could mean, you know, when you look at the dance material, you give yourself over to this sensorial experience.
Samuel Pepys, he's very associated with London, with England, with the UK. Are you trying to embed this performance with a sense of Englishness? And if that's even possible, how does that come across in dance? How do you do English in dance?
Haha. Well, no. I guess I come to the material as a tourist. I didn't know who he was when I started reading him, like maybe 10 years ago. I didn't know anything about him. I didn't know he was so important here until I started working here and saw him like in souvenir stands on keychains. And I was freaking out because I didn't associate those two people. I just thought this was this amazing, obscure diary. Once I understood that he was this incredibly important figure in British history, I decided to kind of discard the parts of him that everyone knew about, like the cheese and the plague and the fire and things like that, even though they are very, very interesting. You guys already know all that. And in America, of course, he's completely unknown. So Americans thought he was this really obscure diarist. Super interesting to bring him here. It was like I did a piece based on an Agnes Varda film script from the 60s. And it was super obscure when we did it in New York, but we brought it to France, to many, many cities in France. And strangely enough, they really embraced it. Sometimes it's really cool to see an outsider's perspective. It's like Ivo's done a lot of American texts lately, and it's interesting for us to see this Belgian's perspective on our world, and maybe at the distance has a little bit of friction that you can't bring to your own, you know, material that you understand so well, quote unquote, yeah.
And then finally, very quickly, what's ahead in the future? Are you working on any future projects that we should be excited about?
I'm excited about a couple. I'm still working on American Utopia, by the way, and it's coming back here to the O2 in October.
I will be attending.
Awesome. We're adding two new songs, so I'm still working with them on those songs. One from the new album and one Talking Heads song. But Big Dance is going to be working with Anne Carson. Anne Carson is the foremost English-speaking Greek translator of the classics. And like the Pepys Project, I love to interact with old text, really interested, and feel in my body, in a sense, the connection between the past and the present. So we're doing a version that she wrote of Antigone, which is a radical feminist philosophical take on Antigone that's really, really wild and important right now. We'll be doing it with an all-female identified cast.
Annie B. Parson there, speaking to Tom Hall. And for more information on the events taking place as part of Dance Umbrella in London, head to danceumbrella.co.uk. The festival's on until the 21st of October. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Sheena Rossiter will be familiar to many Monocle 24 listeners, being our correspondent covering events across Brazil, Canada and beyond.
But she was in London this week to discuss another of her many talents, filmmaking.
Her documentary, Three Siblings, has been showing as part of London's Rain Dance Film Festival.
Earlier, Sheena spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to tell him more about the film.
Three Siblings is a documentary short. It's 23 minutes. It takes place in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And basically, three siblings with different gender identities and sexual orientations, we follow them around during Pride Month and how they kind of overcome these challenges that they face every day in Brazil, which is the homophobia and transphobia that exists in Brazil. And just to give our listeners an idea of how prevalent it is in Brazil, one LGBTQ person is murdered every day in Brazil. So it's very shocking. Statistics. And since these three siblings are from a favela, it's even more challenging because they have even larger hurdles to overcome every day. So we follow them around during Pride Month, and then when they go to the Sao Paulo Pride Parade, which is the world's largest with about 3.5 million people in attendance, they bond in unexpected ways. So that's what's really curious about it. And it's really a more uplifting documentary, if you will.
No, definitely. I felt very much this kind of the uplifting tone because there's a lot of violence. But what you see with those three brothers, it's a lot of love and warmth among them. You know, even I love the straight brother. He's almost a bit protective of the other two as well. How did you find them, by the way?
It's rather interesting. So my partner, my life partner, and also my producing partner, Sandro Silva, is born and raised in this favela, Monte Azul, in the south zone of Sao Paulo. So it really started back in June 2016. Our nephew was turning 1 year old. We came from Rio de Janeiro, where we were living at the time, to Sao Paulo for the birthday party. While we were at the birthday party, I noticed Luigi Milla, the transgender sibling. And then I just asked Sandro, oh, who's that? And he's like, oh, well, that's Angelo's sibling. That's Luigi Milla. And so I thought, okay, that's rather interesting. And then I didn't really think too much about it. The Olympics happened. We got on with our lives. We were quite busy working. Fast forward to March 2017, and all these mega events had already happened in Brazil, and our goddaughter slash niece, it was her christening. And of course, we had to go to Sao Paulo and throw a big party for that. So we go there for that. And then I notice the gay brother walk into the room at the party, Victor, and he's very flamboyant, as you'll see from the film, that I had to take note. And so, of course, I asked Sandro, who's that? And he said, that's Angelo's brother. And then the other sibling is a transgender. And I said, wait, they're all related? He said, yeah, they're all related, very matter of fact. And I just said, that's fascinating. Can we do a documentary about them? So that was Sandro's role, was to really get them on board. And because they are longtime family friends of his, that is how they kind of got on board.
That's fantastic. And have they seen the final results?
Only Luigi Milla. We were in Brazil back in March and we tried to get all three of them together so they could see the final results. And that was a little bit like herding cats. Just to try to get everybody in the same place at the same time was rather difficult. Luigi Milla does approve of it and they are very happy about the success. And the one beautiful thing that actually really came out of this documentary is, as you'll see from the documentary at the beginning, of the film, Angelo, the straight sibling, is a little bit more standoffish. He is a little bit homophobic, a little bit transphobic at the beginning of the film. But when we went through this process of following them around during Pride Month, they did actually grow closer, which has still resulted in their everlasting relationship today as siblings. They are closer and they understand each other more because of the documentary.
And Sheena, I find this documentary very relevant because we're close to an election in Brazil where you have, well, clearly a homophobic candidate leading the polls. I mean, there's a lot of rejection against him as well. But I also see that in Brazil, especially among the, you know, the LGBT communities and women as well, a lot of kind of, you know, protests in the streets, you know, because people, they are reacting against this homophobia and this kind of, you know, horrible thoughts of a candidate like Jair Bolsonaro. How did you feel in your experience in Brazil about that?
Well, I did interview Jair Bolsonaro once at a protest. Particularly, that was the protest that was in favor of impeaching former President Dilma Rousseff when she was ousted back in 2016. So as just to recap for our listeners who Jair Bolsonaro is, he's a right-wing candidate, a neoliberalist, and he is basically homophobic, against women, against people of color back down in Brazil. And some of his comments about homophobia were, he said he would not want to have a son who is gay. He'd rather be dead. So there is that huge element that we are facing in Brazil. And there is a big movement now, especially with women, the Ellie Now, Not Him movement as well. So I do feel that this is a very relevant moment because Jair Bolsonaro is the front-running candidate at the moment for the Brazilian elections, because a lot of people feel that the Workers' Party, with Lula and Dilma Rousseff, the 13-year rule that party had failed the system, especially for middle-class Brazilians. So they're more leaning towards the right now. So I feel it is a very important moment to have a positive documentary that brings these more marginalized communities in Brazilian society to the forefront in the media, because not only is this family LGBTQ family, but they are also people of color as well that are also very marginalized in Brazil.
And they're also three extremely interesting characters as well.
Exactly.
And I can understand why the film has been a success. So tell us, Sheena, first of all, why are you in London? And you've been to quite a few festivals already, right?
Yes, so this film has shown at 17 film festivals already in about 9 countries, I want to say, and it's won 4 awards. But I'm very excited to be here in London because the film will be showing at the Raindance International Film Festival. And then there'll be a second screening next week on October 7th at 12:45 p.m. And that will be showing at View Cinemas here around Piccadilly in London. I'm also excited to say that a week after, I'll be in Iceland at the Reykjavik International Film Festival, where it will also be showing there, and I'll be taking part in the talent lab to help basically create Three Siblings into a feature film.
Sheena Roster there discussing her documentary Three Siblings. Head to donnaannafilms.com for more information. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Another episode of the Monocle Weekly.
What a show it was. So many interesting stories. And we said we're in the midst of a sort of explosion of culture all around London. And we had some cultural enlightenment provided by our guests on the programme. And by Fernando, of course, as well. And by your good self. Shall we thank the characters behind the Glass Org?
I think we must.
Today's programme was produced by Tom Hall and Augustin Macellari. Hold on. Two places at once, very clever. Our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. My great thanks to them both. We'll be back again at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Augustin Macellari.
Goodbye.